ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Voting is open for ABC Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. Go to abc.net.au/top100books and pick up to 10 of your favourites. Choose from the inspiration list or add your own title. In October, we'll tally everyone's votes and count down from 100 to number one on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. You don't have long. Vote now at abc.net.au/top100books.
Hello there, dear and loyal listener. Welcome to The Minefield as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. I feel like you should be rewarded in some way. I would love if, for example, we had a card and you could get it stamped every episode you listen to and then you get the 10th one free, which would not be a discount, but at least it would make you feel special. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. I probably should have saved this for off-air. Well, Lee Darley is my name. Scott Stevens is my bewildered co-host. Hello, Scott.
That was a great way of setting things up. I saw what you were doing. It was magnificent as it was unfolding.
And then it crashed?
No.
Anyway, that's not the topic for today. What is the topic?
All right. So there are any number of things that marketing departments and social media platforms are going to have to pay eternally for. One of those things is the taking of words that I think are pretty important, words that have a certain degree of human value to them, and trading on the value that we attach to them, the degree of human warmth and intimacy and connection that we discern in and through them, and essentially debasing them so that they become little more than ways of establishing connections or of hyping up or cultivating customer behavior. One of the examples that I love going for, Willie, I don't know if we've ever talked about it on this show. Mm. Think about the word share. I actually think it's a wonderful word. But think about the context in which once upon a time we used it. Maybe you were fighting with your brother and your mother told you that you really needed to share. You know, that is maybe your first experience of learning what it means to make a small moral sacrifice for the sake of a greater good. Yes, you have to go without maybe not the entire thing, but if you go without a little bit, then a prevailing peace might settle into your fraternal relationship. That's your first instruction in democracy, right?
But there is a cost. That's the point.
But there is a cost. Yeah. Or if you think of, you know, if someone said to you, you know, Waleed, I just want to share something with you, they're not going to be talking to you about the scuttlebutt from the Richmond Tigers locker room. Chances are, if they talk about something that they want to share with you, there is a certain degree of intimacy. There is a confidence. There is a heart-to-heart.
That's interesting. You don't share gossip.
No, you don't. What you're saying?
I don't know about.
No, you gossip. That. You gossip.
You don't share it.
I don't think you share it.
That's interesting.
And even within certain religious circles, you know, if during a church service someone was invited to share a testimony or share an experience that they had of divine grace, you're bringing something highly personal out into the public. You're offering something of yourself. So you take the idea of sharing and all of the goodness that we tend to associate with that, and then you slap it on a social media platform, and it becomes the word that we use to describe anonymously or impersonally forwarding a link to somebody else. In the meanwhile, the act of forwarding accrues the sense of value or human significance or human touch, let's call it, that already attaches to the word share. I think something similar is going on when I want you to friend me.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you were talking, I was saying all of the social media words are like this. So friend, like.
Like is probably the defensible one because like is kind of meh.
Yeah. No,
it was okay. If it was love, that's something
different. Sure. Well, but increasingly it is, right? You click on the heart.
Yeah, it's true.
That becomes a favorite or a bookmark or whatever. But I think if I say I like this book to you, I think that's conveying a weight that is different to if you held up a picture of the book and I clicked the like button. Hmm. There's a thinning out of the concept there. I agree it's not as thick a concept initially as things like friend. and perhaps share. But yeah, anyway, I think we've established the concept.
Sure. So the harbinger, the original sin, could we say, of the debasement of words suggesting human emotion and warmth and touch is probably the word loyalty.
Ooh.
Yeah. It, as far as we can tell, it pretty much goes back to the decision of marketing departments in the 1940s to try to cultivate or otherwise influence consumer behavior by establishing connections between consumers and not simply the product that they're consuming or using or purchasing, but the brand, the company behind it. So that through thick and thin, through price raises, through corporate scandals, through the introduction of other competitors into the market, what they want to generate is a degree of customer loyalty, that you're going to stick with us, that you're going to keep coming back. And then that transmutes over, particularly the last, say, three decades, into loyalty programs. Now, I find this offensive on almost every level. Because from my understanding of loyalty, loyalty is meant to suggest a good in and of itself. If you are loyal to something, it's because you see, you discern a certain value. Here, I'm not going to say in that thing, but let's say in that entity, in that social group, in that relationship, in the friend, in my friendship with that person. Loyalty has no end beyond itself. There is a value. There is something about this that enhances my life. There is a good that this entity, that this person, that this group, that this nation represents to me. Therefore, I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to stand by it.
Isn't that the end?
No.
For example, if I were to say I'm loyal to my country or I'm loyal to my king or whatever, there's an end bound up in that. I don't think...
It might be common defense. It might be mutual protection. It might be I'll have your back, you have mine.
It might also just be solidarity with the people with whom you share a nation or a space, a city, whatever. I think I agree with the thrust of where you're going with this.
Hang on, Molly, wouldn't you say, though, that whatever it is that you value in that, it is inherent in the thing itself? So it would be inappropriate to say these multiple acts of showing loyalty will be rewarded by some further benefit coming to you once you've accrued 20, 25 of them.
Yeah, so the cheapening of the concept of loyalty via commercial descriptions of what is essentially repeat custom.
That's right.
I agree with that. I'm not sure I fully agree with your characterization of loyalty as having no end. I think there is something about it that does reveal what one values in life or what one thinks constitutes the good life or is important.
Oh, we're saying the same thing, Waleed. What I was meaning to say, and I apologize if I didn't make this clear, that the end is inherent to the act of being loyal to the thing itself, that there's something inherent in that thing. There's something about it that you value, that the fact that there's some further or additional reward kind of makes it superfluous.
Whereas once it's cast in the commercial realm in this way, it's no longer that. It's about the seeking of additional rewards.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now we come up against a problem. If someone were to ask you, should loyalty alongside courage, say, or temperance, should loyalty be counted among the virtues? What would be your gut level reaction?
Yeah, I think I would probably instinctively say yes.
And why is that? What characteristics or qualities of loyalty would nudge you in that direction?
So I think what we're talking about when we say loyalty is a virtue, or we think of it that way, is the preparedness of one to cease being opportunistic or to, at times, sacrifice for your sake or the sake of this thing or for the preservation of something grander. So, for example, when would we think about loyalty in ordinary life? You know, when you're at high school and you're in the middle of all kinds of petty friendship group debates and so on, and this person doesn't like me anymore and so on, and you could benefit from abandoning me too, but you don't. You're loyal to me. There's an element of sacrifice there, the foregoing of a short-term benefit, I think, that is the reason I would instinctively think of it in the, as virtue.
So here the contrast would be loyal on the one hand versus being a fair-weather friend on the other.
Yes.
When it's convenient to abandon, you will abandon.
Yep.
Or, sorry, when it's advantageous to abandon, you will abandon.
And so self-interest doesn't rule the day. There's something bigger than that.
Yeah. Nice. But surely you would also say that loyalty, its virtuousness or not, is judged by that to which you are being loyal. So for instance, being loyal to something that is vicious, doesn't that then cast a pall on the act of being loyal? In other words...
So the person to whom I'm loyal is now guilty or charged with committing serial murder. My loyalty still...
Or that person has dirt on you. And you know that if you're not loyal to them, that they are corrupt enough.
Yeah, I don't call that loyalty.
Okay, good.
I don't know. I cast that in terms of blackmail, and I just think it's a different species of thing.
Interesting. So look, there is a live debate in both political philosophy and moral philosophy about whether loyalty really should be considered a virtue or whether it's maybe a malformed form of something that probably could be more accurately described as a combination of trust and trustfulness or trustworthiness. Maybe if loyalty should be something maybe a bit more like fidelity, not so much to a person, but to that which the two of you have in common, some kind of underlying commitment. And then there are those who think that loyalty really is something almost entirely emotional. It is an emotive bond that tends to attract to those who are closest to us, those who are most advantageous to us. Hence, it seems appropriate to refer to loyalty to one's family, to one's immediate, you know, if you think about living in another nation and someone begins criticizing Australia, you immediately get a bit defensive. You feel the further away from home you are, you feel loyal to your home country. No one else has the right to criticize it. This is why someone like Judith Sklar has said that loyalty has the peculiar quality of being almost entirely reactive. Loyalty tends to flare up in response to some threat from without, which suggests that at the heart of loyalty is something like group solidarity. It's something like an attempt to close ranks and to find a way of defending oneself against a charge from without, against a threat from without. And this, of course, is then what we usually see when statements or remarks of the importance of national loyalty or loyalty to a common cause, or when opprobrium is hurled on those who are disloyal. When those things usually come up during times of either peak nationalism or in the face of national threats.
So you touched on something very interesting there, because at the same time as I think I would instinctively regard loyalty as virtuous, I do regard charges of disloyalty as frequently promiscuous.
Nice. Good. Good. That's right.
So I understand that. I don't know. So I think I even mentioned solidarity in trying to explain what's happening when we say we're loyal to something. But I don't know that it's the whole field. So if I think about being loyal to my mother, for example, I don't think of that as solidaristic.
No, but it is deeply affective, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's bound up in duty, in honouring what she has given me, the sacrifices she's made for me, the majesty of the station, if you like.
Mm.
So if I were to defend my mother, and let me just say, there is no one has any reason ever to say anything bad about my mother, so I've never had to defend her. But hi, Mum, if you're listening. She is listening, I've no doubt. But if I imagine myself having to defend her, I don't think of that as a solidaristic. If anything, if you want to cast that in terms of the ancient instincts or emotions or even virtues, I would say it's honorific.
Hmm.
That's quite different from solidaristic.
So, I mean, here you are invoking the idea of hierarchy, though, that loyalty is an act of deference.
Not always. I think loyalty exists at various planes.
Mm-hmm.
So in the context of the example with one's mother, for example, yeah, I would say there's probably something hierarchical there. And I would be more than happy to say, yes, your mother rightly sits at the top of a certain hierarchy.
Mm.
But I wouldn't say that if I'm loyal to my friend. I don't think that's about hierarchy.
No, that's right.
It's about something else.
Could I just suggest to you then that as soon as you move it onto a horizontal plane,
yeah,
I think there's something really interesting going on at that point. I mean, my immediate sense is that loyalty as such has two aspects or two dimensions to it. One is, taking a leaf out of Judith Sklar's book, there is something reactive about loyalty. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to profess loyalty when there's no countervailing threat, when there's nothing from without that is, say, raising a charge or calling something into question. Loyalty is a kind of locking of arms in the face of something extraneous. I don't think it's necessarily always that it needn't be a physical thing. But there is something about defense, safeguarding, that I think is at the heart of the notion of loyalty. I also seem to think that loyalty often has, however slightly you want to inflect it, a degree of a hierarchical dimension to it. It is as if loyalty here is owed. Something has been done, or something exists apart from oneself to make the act of loyalty something that is rightly required.
Is obligation always hierarchical? Or duty?
I think duty is. I'm not entirely sure.
So, for example, a parent can be loyal to their child.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a hierarchical concept.
No.
That's actually more, what's that? That's anchored in a kind of deep, almost inarticulable love.
Either love or, I mean, I've been a coach of kids' sports teams.
Mm-hmm.
The fanciful way that some parents overestimate the athletic abilities of
their
children strikes me as borderline delusional. And the way that they defend their child's right to be out on the court or out on the field, I think...
Or against a bullying charge at school.
Yeah, sure. So I think there is a kind of defense of the family name or defense of progeny and thereby defense of one's own ability to be regarded as a good parent. I mean, there are all sorts of things that are bound up. Look, I'm not trying to make a hard and fast rule that it always has a hierarchical dimension to it, but I do think it usually has that reactive dimension. And there usually is some sense of there's something that is owed, there's something that is warranted about this act of loyalty. When you're talking about a relationship between friends, when we're talking about relationships among people, among employees within an organization that has a very strong ethos, that has a very strong purpose, or some kind of, not so much a code of conduct, but a list, a carefully formulated series of principles, things that are meant to be guiding the life and the conduct of that organization. When we're talking about, say, friendship, when we're talking about co-workers within a community, I would even say maybe when we're within a democracy, I'm not entirely sure loyalty is quite the right register to be using. Because, for instance, if a friend has done something inexcusable, that may not be cause to break the friendship altogether. But there would be grounds that rest beneath the friendship. Some common sense of shared moral value. Some articulated over the course of your friendship series of common commitments. There would be something inherent to that friendship that could be appealed to as a way of calling that friend to account. Whereas simple blind loyalty, ride or die, I'm with you to the end, that can often betray the conditions of the friendship itself by betraying that which underlies the friendship and gives it its moral substance. You could say that a group of employees coming together to deflect a scandal that may be overwhelming an organization so that, you know, its enemies can't see the cracks, so that people can't see you bleed. You may well actually be sacrificing or denying or renouncing the series of underlying principles that make that organization a morally serious organization to begin with. This is all another way of saying, within loyalty, I'm not sure it makes sense to refer, for instance, to trust and then trustworthiness. Those two things entail, yes, obligation, but also reciprocity. As an employee, you would want the organization to be responsive to its own professed ideals and also to the internal criticisms of its own employees. Within a friendship, you would want there to be, yes, an act of trust or fidelity from one friend to another, but also you would expect there to be a degree of reciprocity and responsiveness on the part of the other friend so that you can call one another to account on the basis of some kind of shared underlying commitment. And it's that, I think, it's that appeal, if I can put it this way, downwards into that which undergirds or provides the conditions of possibility for that relationship. It's that that may well defy the logic of obligation, that there is something about the organization, there's something about this person to whom a higher obligation is owed. This is where I'm wondering if we don't come up against the limits of loyalty as a virtue and recognize that what it is that makes these relationships tenacious, that which gives them their moral grounding, is a kind of appeal to something that is deeper than something that is sustaining of the relationship generally, and on the basis of which a really elaborate process of trust and trustworthiness, of critique and responsiveness can be articulated. I'm not sure if that really can be mapped out along the parameters of loyalty. Maybe you disagree, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying really hard to avoid this becoming merely semantic because I think where we might be heading is, I don't like this word for this. I'd rather this word for this. And then, okay, sure. And we're just disagreeing with ways of describing a particular thing as opposed to really interrogating the limits of a concept. I think part of the problem we have in this conversation is that we use this word loyalty to describe a series of feelings, relationships that are vastly different.
Yeah.
So as you were talking about an appeal to the values that lie beneath the relationship of loyalty, kind of the moral substrate of the relationship, the example I was thinking off the top of my head was people within the Catholic Church at a time when it was embroiled in child sex abuse scandals, for example. So I can see there being a way in which two versions of loyalty could play out there. One is loyalty to the institution, its reputation, its wealth, perhaps, whatever, right? Defend.
Guarding against reputational damage.
Yeah. The other is, well, no, if this institution means anything, it is surely the moral and theological content of its doctrines, that is what it's about. It is not about the valorization of bricks and mortar of certain people in certain places and with certain titles, but it is about the ideas that bring the church into life as a serious moral force. So either of those you could describe as loyal.
Can I just say, well, another example would be Jean-Paul Sartre's refusal to criticize the plain, evident, unjustifiable monstrousness of Stalinism, because he didn't want to give succor to the critiques of communists, and he didn't want to give ammunition to the capitalists. You would say that surely would be a kind of deformed sense of loyalty to a cause.
Well, as to whether it's deformed or not, I guess it depends on your political calculus, right?
So
I imagine by the way, we see this all the time. Pick a conflict. I mean, I'm thinking of one in particular, but pick a conflict.
Sure.
And you see this play out all the time. But the moral argument that lies beneath that is actually the greater wrong would be to undermine this overweening structure of justice, liberation, whatever it is that you might. And so I'm making a pragmatic joke. Now, maybe it's not that. Maybe it's just partisanship and it's just bluster and all this sort of thing. Maybe it's just about wanting to maintain your reputation within certain circles. There are all these things that could go in. And we're having this word loyalty do a lot of work. An example, what about your loyalty to something like a sporting team? You know, we've had examples of sporting teams embroiled in controversy for off-field matters, right? But the loyalty that one has for a sporting team, actually, I would argue, although there are constant attempts to try to make it this, it is not something that rests on a moral bedrock. It is not something that rests on certain ideological foundations that are then easily shaped. So that's why I find it always a bit uncomfortable. Uncomfortable is not the right word. Almost ill-fitting. When people try to make one's loyalty to one's team a moral commitment that is therefore shaken by moral. In sport, I don't know if we're going to go too far down the sporting example, but sport is a particular thing because actually the greatest crimes within sport tend to be the ones that are against the internal logic of the sport rather than against grander moral ideas, right? Performance-enhancing drugs, that's the existential crisis in the sporting relationship because it's violating the axioms that are inherent to the whole enterprise, right? Rather than trying to bring in from outside a series of moral considerations or axioms that were never really part of the, for want of a better metaphor, contract that I signed with my team. So to the extent that I present my sporting attachments as moral, I do so in a pantomime way. I regard Collingwood as evil. I don't really mean they're evil. I have
Except
Collingwood supporting friends. Yeah. you know, some great people, Barry for Collingwood, etc. But part of the pantomime we're involved in, part of the contract, and part of what feeds into my loyalty and my blind loyalty is that that's the fun bit. Yeah. So I don't know exactly how far we want to take all these examples in interrogating a concept like loyalty because we use it in such varied ways. And in some ways it returns us to the beginning, doesn't it, of the commercial uses of loyalty, which I agree are a kind of thinned out, perhaps even debauched facsimile of the very concept of loyalty. But the fact that the word does stretch that way kind of, I think, indicates the ways in which it's used in so many varying ways. And maybe that's the limit that I place on the inquiry in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, that's fair. And I would just add to that, this is why it makes no sense, it seems to me, to describe acts of civil disobedience either within the law or on the edges of law that are making appeals to a kind of higher law or the higher principles of the law or the higher goals of democracy. That's why it makes no sense to me to describe acts of civil disobedience as disloyal to the life of a nation or to a democratic community.
Well, it depends on why they're done and to what, yeah.
Sure. And, you know, there are forms of intra-democratic activity that are so radically destabilizing that it really could be regarded as being undermining to the conditions of democratic life. But strictly speaking, that's not what civil disobedience is doing. It's almost on the basis of a deeper loyalty, as Ralph Waldo Emerson would put it, a deeper loyalty compels me to disobey the law in this particular form.
And it becomes a question of loyalty to what? I mean, the most obvious example to hand at the moment is the division over what counts as loyalty in, say, the Ben Robert Smith case.
Good,
where you have people, soldiers, who blow the whistle and give evidence. And I say this without prejudice to the trial. I'm just talking about the structure of it, the concept. Is to come and give evidence in a trial like that, an act of disloyalty to him, to the military and so on, or is that actually the fulfillment of one's loyalty?
Perfect.
Yeah.
That's good
example. Okay. Should we bring in a guest to rescue us from this quagmire that we've created? You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. We have a guest.
And our guest is our good friend, Fareed Zaid. He's senior lecturer in cognitive psychology at Monash University. Fareed, welcome to The Minefield.
It's a pleasure to be here with you both. Thank you. I'm not promising I'm going to rescue either of you from the quagmire. I found it fascinating listening to you two talk about this because it's a concept and a theme that's been circling in my mind for quite a while now. And I'm going to start with a little humility and admit that, Waleed, I think you changed my mind somewhat.
Oh.
I've shifted.
Do we have to book another guest then? It'll say what you were going to say.
Well, my argument was going to be that loyalty is a corrupt virtue if a virtue at all. But you actually convinced me with your sporting example that perhaps it can sometimes live outside the moral domain altogether.
That's interesting.
Putting that example aside, I do think, and let's circle back to the beginning of your conversation around marketing. I think marketing agencies and corporations more broadly have both corrupted on a superficial level, but also co-opted virtue, the potential virtue of loyalty. And they corrupted it because they made it transactional. Like, what does it mean to be loyal when you're getting rewarded for it with points? What they're actually asking you to do is to book the more expensive flight and we'll compensate you somewhat with some points.
Mm.
And so you're getting rewarded for the inertia of fidelity and maybe perhaps also the feeling of nobility, that there's a little bit of morality intertwined within it. So on a superficial level, they've corrupted it. But I think they've also co-opted the more sinister ways that loyalty moves in our society. And they've done this because one of the fundamental drives of human beings is the need to belong and the fear of being abandoned. And so they push those biological innate levers that we all have.
Can I just, on that, let me just get you flesh it out. Are you saying that when I choose to book the flight, that's a bit more expensive but gives me the points? Or when I choose to buy my coffee from this place as opposed to that because it gets me closer to the free coffee than whatever. Are you saying that what's churning in the background there is a sense that I will be abandoned by this company, that I'll be kicked out of a club? Or is it, would it be better to say, actually, it's just a brutally self-interested transaction? I just calculate that I save more money by buying coffee this way and getting the free coffees, or I quite like the access to the luxury lounges I get from being the, and I don't really care for, I don't care what they think of me and I don't care what I think of them. What do you think is the better description of what's
going? I think the fear of abandonment as a human being, as part of the fundamental experience of the human condition, intertwines with the word loyalty. And so when you hear a loyalty scheme, I think it's pulling some unconscious levers at the same time as potentially you acting in a self-interested
way. So it does work on the heart.
My argument is yes.
Hang on. There could actually be a way, though, of splitting the difference between the two so that this connection doesn't seem quite as radical as maybe you might think. I mean, you could say that group loyalty, or describe it as group solidarity. I realize that that's a redundant use of the word group, but you get the point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Group loyalty isn't just something that I show to others as a form of fealty or devotion, but it is also a forward-paying promise that when something comes against me, in other words, this is like the NATO alliance, when something might come against me, the group will then have my back. I mean, there is a compelling argument to be made that the whole thing that makes loyalty an affective phenomenon that tends to be strongest with those who are closest to oneself, family, tribe, nation, and so on, is that all loyalty is ultimately self, I'm not saying I agree with this, but that all loyalty is ultimately self-interested. If I do this, it will eventually be better for me in the long run. As soon as you add that commercial inflection, and yes, we will give you every 15th coffee free. That is then
that's
just
a bad loyalty scheme, Scott. Bad loyalty scheme.
15 to 1.
I've got it down to 8, I think. That's the best one.
The NATO example is an interesting one in the era of Donald Trump and how much weight you can put on that alliance. But putting that aside, I also don't want to get bogged down in the marketing conversation because I think that's the harmless version of loyalty, if there was a harmless one. And if you think that corporations psychologically manipulating you is harmless. But putting that aside, I think when I speak of loyalty as being a fake virtue, I'm talking on a much more deeper concept of virtue that runs through our society. And it's this requirement that when it's time to speak up because injustice is occurring, you should stay silent. You should close ranks and you should demonstrate solidarity. And non-disclosure agreements is a form of that. The scandal that overwhelmed the Sydney Swans and every single question that's been asked of a Sydney Swans representative and the response of no comment is another example of closing ranks because we will deal with this internally. Loyalty outweighs all other considerations. And that's my problem with the idea. It's appropriating and carrying much more weight than it deserves.
The non-disclosure agreement, I don't think, well, I suppose it depends on the scenario you were imagining when you say that, but I don't think of these as exercises in loyalty. I think of them as exercises...
False loyalty?
Well, just brand protection and self-interest.
No, no. It's legally coerced loyalty. It's wanting the behavior that loyalty promises without the affective commitment to that behavior.
Yeah, but so why do I sign it? I sign it out of a self-interest. I don't sign it because I want to protect the reputation of the company that's done X, Y, Z to me. I might, but I very much doubt that's the case. I do it because that will get me the better payout. I don't want to go through the courts or the argument, the negotiation or whatever it is that I'm trying to avoid. In other words, it might be that the people within the company that are asking for it to be signed are doing so out of a sense of fidelity or loyalty to the company. And I know you've got a separate understanding of fidelity to loyalty, but anyway, just it might be they're doing that. It might be they're just doing what they think their contract demands of them. It might be it's just a purely financial transaction. But I don't think the signing of it would be that. This is a similar case, the Sydney Swans case. There are all sorts of reasons you might want to say no comment, not the least of which is that at the time you're being asked, there's a police investigation and you could corrupt that entire thing, or that it's genuinely not appropriate for you to comment for all sorts of reasons that are not about the organisation or whatever. Or it might be that you have an understanding of events and the effect they're having on people that you do work with every day that you think really matter, not purely out of loyalty, although that might be mixed up in it, but actually out of a serious calculation as to what the effects are from this vantage point that people out there cannot see and therefore don't factor into their... In other words, I see the point you're making. I think it gets really hard once we start concretizing them, because inevitably we run into...
how it looks like in practice.
Yeah, we always run into this, you know, cacophony of factors.
Yep.
That seems
the NDA reference I was making was regarding the idea or the existence of NDAs in our society. It's right. Not the signing in self-interest.
Right.
It's the requirement to sign so that no further investigation occurs.
Yep. Okay.
So justice often is
covered
up. I want to push a little bit more against your intuitions, Waleed. What would you say to the thought, or I mean the reflection, that loyalty only comes up when something has gone wrong? The ideas of loyalty or the request for loyalty is only ever really discussed when there's a controversy, or when, like you said, in high school, there was petty fights. You're never asked to stay loyal. You're never asked for solidarity in good times. It's a request for silence when speaking up is more appropriate.
Yeah, so the way I interpret this, and again, I'm wary we could be doing semantics. The way I think about this is, no, the loyalty thing is there the whole time, and you might show it all the time in daily life. It perhaps becomes sharpest and most clearly into focus. The demands of it become clearest when there is that moment of sacrifice or decision and so on. So in other words, think of it a bit like a philosophical commitment someone might have to free speech. It's not that they only have that commitment to free speech when someone says something offensive. That commitment might be there all the time. It's just that it shows, whether or not it is a real commitment, might show up in those moments. But I don't think it's a thing that springs into existence simply at the moment of crisis. My question for you on the basis of that is, am I pointing to an actual difference in our conception of it here, or am I just describing it in language that you choose not to use, but we're saying the same thing?
I think we're mostly aligned.
Yeah.
You and Scott said 20 minutes ago that this is in part a conversation about semantics and definitions. I agree. I guess my argument is this, if I was to summarize it in a couple of sentences. When you extract all the virtues that loyalty is pointing to, there's nothing left.
Hmm.
So truthfulness, faithfulness, honor, integrity, goodness. We have names for virtues that signal something much more concrete. Loyalty co-opts that. It points to the bundle and names it, but it doesn't actually belong in the bundle. It doesn't actually exist on its own. When you take all those other virtues out, there's nothing left but compromise and silence. And most challenging for me to accept the fact that loyalty allows good, decent human beings to feel virtuous when they're acting without virtue.
Hmm. I think that's a powerful argument. Let's apply it to the case of a parent whose child has been convicted of a serious crime.
Okay.
They have a residual loyalty to that child. That might mean they believe they didn't do it. It might mean they accept they did it, but they nonetheless believe they're a good person and they will stand by them. They will not abandon them. So all these things I would describe as loyal.
No. Well,
you wouldn't?
No. I'm sorry. This is the wrong example. The example isn't your child has been convicted and out of parental love and familial fealty or devotion, you remain emotionally and morally connected to that child. It is your child has done something horrible. Out of loyalty, you help them evade police capture and prosecution.
No, that's one example. I don't know that's the only. This is where I kept running into the semantic part of this. I might just believe they didn't do it. And the thing that might be driving that.
Well, in that case, of course, if you sincerely believe that they're innocent and you want to be their parent in the time of need, then that makes perfect sense to stay loyal. But I think there are two promises here. Mm. One, in this example of a parent-child relationship, one is I'll be here for you when things go badly.
Yep. Mm.
And so that's a promise of presence. It's a promise of just I'm staying.
But
I'm
not loyal,
abandoning you. The other promise is I'll cover up for you.
Yeah, mm,
that's right.
And I think within loyalty, both of those exist.
Would you say that both have to exist for it to be called loyalty?
No, I don't think they're necessary and sufficient. I'm just giving you I'm trying to disentangle this example.
Yeah.
I think people just haphazardly refer to that situation as being loyal. Whether you stay present or whether you are active in the cover-up, you're being a loyal parent. And I don't think they're the same thing. And I guess that's what comes down to in this conversation, in this argument.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my, I think, very loyal co-host, actually. Fareed Zaid is our guest. He's not loyal at all, but he is here to provoke. Senior lecturer in cognitive psychology at Monash University. Scott.
An excellent example of just what it is we've been talking about. Anyone who has not watched the HBO short-run series Task, the final episode where a father addresses his adopted son who has killed his adopted mother, the father's wife, and is getting ready to go to jail. That address of devotion on the other side, I think, is the perfect example of constructive, critical, I would call it parental love and devotion. It may well have that dimension of loyalty with it.
Well, does it? I think that's where we're running into each other, isn't it? Is whether we would call that loyalty.
And is that the same loyalty, speaking of TV, since you've opened up this can of worms, Scott, is that the same loyalty that Tony Soprano expects? Is it the same loyalty?
No.
But they speak of loyalty all the time.
That's right. That's right. So let me put something slightly different to you, though, Fareed. I really like your idea of loyalty as a pseudo-virtue, or a debased or slightly deformed virtue. In other words, what gives loyalty its power is that it can be appealed to as if it were morally significant and weighty and meaningful, but the good that it has, it essentially parasitizes on other less complicated virtues. Mm. So let's take the example of loyalty to an organization. This organization could be a corporation, an institution, but it would be something that has something like, say, something a little bit deeper than a code of conduct. There is an ethos. There is a series of principles for which it exists and that are meant to guide the life of that institution. What I find so interesting is that the charge that often goes hand in hand with calls for, requests of, demands for loyalty is, and I think this feeds directly to your point, Fareed, the only way of quote-unquote changing things is from within, point A. Point B, it is a good thing for this organization, for this institution, to continue to exist. Too much publicly aired criticism, too much calling into account, both brings the existence of the corporation into question. It may well jeopardize the entire enterprise. And it guarantees that the person who is doing the criticizing, this might be a whistleblower, this might be a form of loyal opposition, someone committing the corporate equivalents of civil disobedience, that this makes their own usefulness marginal, because the only way of bringing about change is by doing so from within, which usually entails a degree of compromise, a certain amount of dirty hands or hardened hearts. So this seems to me to kind of encapsulate what it is you're saying about the grubbiness, the internal fractures or weaknesses that begin to reveal themselves as soon as you place any significant moral or collective pressure on the practice of loyalty. Whereas something more like full-throated criticism, but on the basis of professed commitments that we publicly have in common, that may be, I mean, you could refer to that as loyal opposition, loyal dissent. Is this, as far as examples go, is this getting closer to what it is you have in mind when you're saying that loyalty is fundamentally found wanting?
Yes. I mean, in part, absolutely, Scott. It's a good example of when a person who would be called disloyal, the whistleblower, is acting to try and support the ideal of the corporation or the nation or whatever the leak of information is trying to achieve. It often goes against the desires of the actual corporation or the actual institution. And so we call them disloyal, where in fact it could be argued that they are more loyal than the rest.
Well, because what we're assuming here is that truthfulness brings with it precarity or precariousness. Just like within any relationship, any significant relationship, a moment of unvarnished truthfulness, what might be called moral encounter, kind of places that relationship on a precipice. Something is going to happen. The entire thing might fall over, or if we proceed together into the future, it's going to be proceeding together under a different aspect. There is a risk that goes along with truthfulness, whereas it seems to me that what you're saying is that loyalty tends to favor the status quo and requires sacrifice and compromise in order for there to be the mere perseverance of the relationship or of the company or whatever.
Absolutely. In my mind, the moral aspects of loyalty require the suppression of truth and the suppression of justice for the sake of just continuance. And so you close ranks. Like I said before, you sign non-disclosure agreements, you say no comment, we're going to deal with this internally, or you make excuses that this person is acting out of character or they were just tired or whatever other potential excuse you can come up with. I guess if I was to summarize this again briefly, I would say that in my mind, the opposite of loyalty isn't betrayal. It's having the courage to be honest when that honesty is going to cost you something real. It seems to me we don't speak of loyalty and disloyalty in those terms in our society.
You've almost got me here.
Okay.
You've almost got me. But let's see if you can get me in the next 13 seconds that we have. Right.
This is like trying to sell a car to a lead.
No, I'm very excited about this. I find this really interesting. I wonder if that description you just gave is a little, there's truth in it, but I wonder if it's a little flat in the sense that who says truth is the most important thing in a relationship, for example? Now, that sounds like a wild thing to say, but let me give you an example. I would regard it as a virtuous thing to set aside an argument with someone where I am convinced, let's say I know the truth is on my side, but to pursue it would become destructive. Now, same sort of thing with justice, particularly if the injustice is against me. Pursuing justice and making that the only thing that matters can be a terrible way to organize societies, relationships, all sorts of things. I think where I'm heading with this is the nature of any virtue is that there are unvirtuous expressions of it. The thing about virtues is that they exist in a balance. The thing that makes someone virtuosic, if you like, is that they know which virtue applies when. Mercy is a virtue. Mercy untethered from every other virtue, such as justice, would be monstrous. Justice is a virtue. Justice without any broader consideration of other virtues, such as forgiveness or mercy, or is also monstrous. Might loyalty be something like that? That there are times where loyalty is virtuous, but there are times where it is not, just like any other thing, any other virtue. Overall, we could call it a virtue, but that's not to say that means it should always have right of way over every other consideration in every circumstance.
I think you're onto something, Waleed, but I think I would buy that argument if you could give me examples where loyalty was subservient to a higher ideal. And I just, from my understanding of loyalty, I don't think that's the case. I think when it is demanded...
It's absolute, you think?
When it's demanded, it's to serve the undermining of other virtues as opposed to supporting them. So
But isn't the same true of mercy and justice? If I demand justice, I am undermining mercy.
Your mercy example was a great example.
Yeah. So, and if I demand mercy, I might be undermining justice.
It's something I need to think about more.
Here's where I think E.M. Forster's Howard's End is in many respects perfect. Margaret Schlegel shows what I think can only be called marital loyalty to her morally deformed husband, Henry Wilcox. Despite the fact that at any moment she could call him to account, she could work on his moral life, the condition of his soul, she knows that by simply being a scold, she's going to undermine the conditions of their marriage. So she is loyalty, almost unquestioningly loyalty. It's up to others to decide whether that's good on her part or bad, until the moment comes when his own moral deformation, Henry Wilcox's moral deformation, is so injurious both to him and to others that loyalty to the marriage demands truthfulness. It demands that the two of them find one another at a precipice. And for her to relinquish that demand, to renounce the imperative at that moment to expose the state of his own moral degeneracy to him and call him to account, that would have undermined and ultimately invalidated the moral conditions of the marriage as a whole. Loyalty, if it's going to mean anything, loyalty must mean there are those moments where absolute truth-telling for the sake of the ongoing survival of this as a moral or morally defensible enterprise, those situations, those circumstances need to be regarded, they need to be understood, they need to be discerned, and they have to be seized, even if that means calling the entire enterprise into question.
I can't argue with that. At some point, and I guess that's my argument as well, loyalty has to take a backseat to a higher virtue. And in your example, it's faithfulness to the marriage or the enterprise of the relationship. I guess we will disagree and continue to disagree where that precipice exists. Mm. For me, it's much earlier on.
Like Interesting. I said
earlier, mm. There are many virtues that describe the ideals that loyalty tries to mimic. And I just don't see it playing us a strong role in our moral life. But of course, this is the beauty of philosophizing about it. We don't have to agree.
Well, the way I would summarize that is, yes, there are moments it must yield, but that is true of every virtue. Mm. So that in itself is not the bit. The bit I find very persuasive in what you're arguing, Fareed, is the idea that actually there is no moral content left in the concept of loyalty once you remove the thing that it's actually pointing to. So the circumstances that we say, where we say that loyalty is a virtue, we're not actually talking about loyalty. We're talking about the thing that loyalty is pointing to. And if you remove that veil and you just have those things, loyalty itself isn't doing the moral work. There's something in that I think that is very powerful. And you might have me there. You might have won me over there, but we'll need to do a sequel or something okay. because I have to go away and think about that. This has been all kinds of fun for me. We'll see how loyal our listeners have been, whether or not they've gotten to the end. By the way, loyalty to this show, absolutely a virtue. I don't think anyone is
undoubtedly.
Fareed, thank you.
Pleasure.
Such a joy. That is it for this episode of The Mindfield. Fareed Zaid, Senior Lecturer in Cognitive Psychology at Monash University, our guest. Before we go, I have a question for you. Have you voted in Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books Countdown? If not, for what are you waiting? Head to the Radio National homepage right now. Cast your vote. This is what is demanded of you as a loyal Radio National listener. We'll be back with more Minefield next week on ABC Radio National. But in the meantime, you can listen to us anytime you like on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.